the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and enemies, welcome to yet another edition of the Mighty CBP, all part of the CBP Media Network. I'm Len. Today, I'm going to be talking to Jaime Garcia, and we've talked to Jaime quite a bit in the past, and we'll get some updates what's going on post-election in El Salvador and figure out what's going on since then, because there has been a lot of talk, especially with Bitcoin. They moved some Bitcoin not too long ago. We'll get into that momentarily, but before we do, I want to just talk about a couple of things. I've got a couple of sponsors I want to talk about. Number one, EasyDNS. They have been with us for, I think, the longest ever. So I want to thank them for entrusting us to talk about their product, because what do they do? There's lots of different things that they do, and they do it for us as well. For example, hosting a website. If you have a website you want to get started, like we did, they are the people to talk to. If you want to have, or if you do have a website and you want to move it over, they are a good place. They are a trusting place. Do your own research, of course, to trust your website. You can also get domain names. You can renew them as well. You can move them over. A lot of different things you could do with them. Email hosting, or you can migrate your emails over. So if you do have email services already and you just want to move it over to a more trusted place, they'll be able to help you out. Virtual private servers. There's a lot of different options you could do with that. For example, you could do BTC Pay servers. That's a pretty cool thing, especially if you are your own merchant and you want to start accepting Bitcoin. This is one way you could do so without going through the process of setting up your own hardware. You could do nodeless implementations, so much more. They've been around for a long time. They've been around since the late 90s, and a lot of other similar companies have come and gone, but they stuck around. They are giving good service. Their private privacy nature, they are really good. We like them. They do our product, our CanadianBitcoiners.com website. So thank you for that. Use the promo code CBP Media. By doing so and signing up, you're going to get 50% off your initial purchase. So do so if you haven't already done so. Second sponsor, Bull Bitcoin. Price of Bitcoin, it's under 70,000, 69,400, it looks like. Pretty good. So you could buy and sell your Bitcoin through Bull Bitcoin. They also give you a few other options. If the fees are starting to climb, I'm not sure what they are today. I didn't check it out, but hypothetically, if they are high, you don't have to buy on-chain and take the hit with using an on-chain fee. They give you the option to buy using Lightning. Lightning is awfully cheap in terms of fees. So you could buy Lightning, you could buy on-chain, two different options. You could also pay your bills with Bull Bitcoin. So if you have your electricity bill, you got a car payment, whatever, and you have a stack of Bitcoin that you're just sitting on, you want to start selling and start using as a way to pay your bills, well, Bull Bitcoin will be the people in the middle to make sure this gets done. So you could start paying your bills with Bull Bitcoin. Also, they do have the option where you could buy gift cards with your Bitcoin. So you could start spending indirectly in the real world your Bitcoin. So you can start living on the Bitcoin standard, just the way Satoshi wanted us to do. The last thing they have are the KYC free buys. I talk about this oh so much because I love it. Go to Canada Post. You load up your, show them your QR code, load up your account with Canadian dollars, and then you can start buying KYC free Bitcoin. Cheapest spread in the game, at least in Canada. I can't say about the rest of the world because I don't have much experience with that. But in Canada, it is the cheapest, easy to do, private, KYC free. How could you go wrong? Check it out. Use our promo code. And if you do that, fund your account and provide the necessary information. $21 will be added to your account. No questions asked. So with that being said, I want to bring in the man of the hour. Jaime, how are you, buddy?
Hey, Len, doing well. Thank you for the invite.
Thanks for coming on. Because this, I think we talked to you a little bit over a month ago. And like I said at that time, I'm going to tell everybody, the carpet, the red carpet is always rolled out to you. Anytime you want to come on the show, Jaime, you're more than welcome to come on the show. You've been a very good friend to us, and you've been providing us some really good information, what's going on in El Salvador and in other parts of the world, too. So I want to just thank you so much for all the service you've done for us here. And I'm giving you some, I'm blowing you here, essentially. So thank you very much for coming on the show once again. It's been a few months since you've been here. I took a look. I think it's November 1st, 2023. So 4 months-ish, 5 months-ish since you've been here. What's gone on in your life since then? Anything new since November 1st? I'd like to get an update with you.
On a personal level, just recovering from a few days of sickness. just the spring brings all kinds of sickness. And it's basically a combination of allergies and germs and flu and everything. And I guess, you know, my only excuse to not being well prepared with a Bitcoiner immune system is that I haven't been eating enough steak. I was an Airbnb that didn't have cast iron skillets. So, you know, unfortunately I was cooking one of those Teflon ones, not enough, run free grain, non-grain fed chicken eggs, you know, all that. I've been eating vegetables.
Oh no, there you go.
Not enough sunlight, vitamin D, probably too much canola oil, all the jazz, right? So, but I'm on the mend, so this is a good way to get back onto things. But on a personal level, super busy too. Like I don't do this for a living. It's just passion of mine on the side, and so my family's my passion, and my kids are quite involved in athletic activities. And right now, the one kid's like been traveling all over Canada and in the U.S. Doing some competitive stuff, and so we've been just following her over. So I got a stack of Telegram and emails to get back to on everything under the sun. But asking everybody to give me grace. And from a Bitcoin perspective, there's been a lot of stuff going on, lots of stuff. I mean, like both on the technical level and the cultural level, as well as things developing in El Salvador. So there's lots of exciting stuff, like the price action and all the things that people get, you know, talk about. I don't really pay too much attention, but, you know, some of the more underground stuff, and especially when it comes to El Salvador, I try to keep my hand in the pulse. So yeah, like there's lots of things to talk about, and, you know, I'm happy to, you know, provide some context. I don't always have the answers, but wherever you want to start, Len.
Well, I want to do a little bit more personal there. Are you still playing soccer?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why I think that's probably why I got sick, because I've been playing a lot of soccer lately, and although I haven't gotten injured, I think that just playing like games back to back and just running myself silly, like being in a couple different teams, guest playing for other teams, like that eventually sort of takes a toll on you. And I think my circadian rhythm's a little bit off, because sometimes we got to play like late at night, and so. And I'm not a fancy player. I'll let you know that. I'm one of those dudes that never scores, but I do all the work behind the scenes, cut some indoors passing lanes, you know, just make sure that everything's neat and out in defense, and redistribute the ball to the ones who can up top. So yeah, we do indoor.
Yeah, you need a workhorse back there just to clean up the mess. And yeah, you're right.
That's me.
Pirlo, like, if you know who he is, Pirlo was the guy that he played a little bit defensively, but he was always feeding the ball out.
Yeah.
And so you needed somebody like that to make the initial pass out to direct the play, and then from there it could go. But indoor is something special because it's a faster game. I've played it before, and wow, like it's just incredibly fast. Is it 5+ a goalie against 5+ a goalie?
Yeah.
Is that
typical? Yeah. You got to constantly scan. You got to constantly scan, because if you receive the ball and you don't know where you're going, like somebody's on you right away. And like I play on I'm on a Legends League now. So Legends is 45 plus. So Legends, and I'm also on Masters, just 35 plus, and regular league. And so I've been playing all three leagues. But like when you play down in the regular league, you get some like teenagers or some 20-some-year-olds who are super fit. Phew, you know, like you got to play like I, you know, even like 5 years ago, I would still try to keep up with them. Now I just got to use the wisdom.
That's good. You are progressing to the next level. Yeah. Have you been traveling? Have you been back to El Salvador in the past few months? Or?
No, not El Salvador. Just all around Western Canada with my daughter. So yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. Now, I want to dive deep a little bit into something more Bitcoin related, actually more El Salvador related. Since you last were here, El Salvador had a general election and they elected a new or re-elected a president, I guess. I'm not sure exactly how to call it because he stepped down. Maybe you could give some insight as to essentially what has happened in the election, what's happened post-election, because as an outsider for me, looks like it was status quo. He ran, he won, and then he just continued working in the office, which he vacated not too long before that. So it seems like it was status quo, but has anything really changed in the grand scheme of things?
So, yeah, I would say that, the big change is it gives El Salvador continuity and stability for the Bitcoin project in a big way. So the elections took place on February 4th of this year. They were observed by several international bodies, including the Organization of American States, the OAS, the UN, and the European Union. Their reports were that there were some irregularities with the election. However, these irregularities weren't in the form of any fraud or untowards sort of a scheming. It was more like Wi-Fi wasn't available. They ran out of, supplies. There was miscommunication, just really mundane stuff. The same kind of irregularities that like you would find in, like any other healthy democracy, right? I'm not saying El Salvador is like a healthy democracy, but in terms of this election, I think that it was widely viewed as open and fair. One of the things that I would say is that the ruling party, New Ideas, Nayib Bukele's party, had a great advantage. They garner more donations. They had a huge machinery. One of the criticisms was that the opposition parties were non-existent in terms of advertising. Like the typical campaign that you see like months in advance didn't take place because, first of all, New Ideas didn't have anything to respond to in terms of either like counter campaigns or anything like that.
And New Ideas, which party are they belonging to, the governing or the opposition party?
It's the governing party, Nayib Bukele's party. So there was like an odd lack of campaigning by all parties. And so sometimes that was viewed kind of like as weird, but just because like in El Salvador, campaigns are huge. It's like there's a lot more money going around. One of the things that didn't happen this year was that the money wasn't, because amazingly, just like in Canada, parties get government funded, but El Salvador didn't advance those funds because they're based on a vote. And so the Ministry of the Treasury gave the money to the parties after the votes were garnered, not in advance. And so they couldn't use those funds to campaign. And so, but other than that, they were pretty open and free from those organizations' perspectives. And Nayib Bukele won like over 80% of the vote, which gave him a huge mandate, huge stamp of approval from the Salvadorian electorate to continue to do what he's been doing. New Ideas elected more deputies in the assembly than they had before, in terms of the proportion of the seats. And why I say that is because actually there was a law that was passed that reduced the number of seats in the assembly from 84 to 60. And so they garnered over 80% of the seats. Wow. So the opposition was decimated, absolutely decimated. If they had, and right now New Ideas has like the ability to pass laws without any negotiation, even with their allies. They decimated their allies even before they had another party that they had to sort of negotiate. Now they don't have to do that. The flip side of the coin is that now there's huge, huge expectations around that. And I think that in a way that they can't really even say and point fingers to the opposition. I think that this second mandate really gives Bukele and his government and the New Idea parties a huge responsibility to deliver. And what the population has been asking for, now that it's vastly agreed and widely agreed that the issue of security has been addressed, that the economy is the one thing that people want improved. They want jobs, they want opportunities, they want Salvadoran people to prosper, and they really want the promise of a prosperous El Salvador. And if Bitcoin's going to be a gateway to improve the economy, they want to feel that, right? But of course, this is kind of where I tell my family and friends in El Salvador that it's really not ultimately up to the government to fix things. There has to be a mindset shift in everybody's mind, that's what they want to do. And so, it's a mindset that has been changing in El Salvador, but it has to take place at a mass level, not just in a few sectors of the population, right? And so, we'll see what happens here. I think that, but in terms of governance and just public policy, I wouldn't say that New Ideas and Bukele have a blank check, but they definitely have a huge mandate. And if they don't deliver, if things don't improve in terms of the economy, which is like, people want to keep the security issue at the forefront and not relinquish one inch from that. But now the expectation is that El Salvador will improve in terms of the economy.
There's a lot that you've said there, and we'll be unpacking a few different nuggets you said there. But initially, I wanted to talk about the election process itself. Mm-hmm. And the fact from the outside, I'm not exactly sure how long it took from when they opened the polls to when they closed it and when they called the election, but it seemed like it was rather quick. It didn't draw out for days, weeks, or months. It was just, they counted the ballots, made a decision, and went from there. So you were talking about healthy democracies. There are some out there, maybe you're looking down south, where it takes them a heck of a long time just to figure out who's won a particular election. Now, granted, the size of the election is different. The population of El Salvador is somewhere in the vicinity of 6.5, maybe 7 million people at that. And the United States is, 350 million people. So there's a huge difference between the two. I guess I get it. But still, it's a copy-paste situation. So how long did it take to come out with a decision with the El Salvador election? And based on that, was there any criticism on how the process was run or anything? Or did it just seem like, I know you mentioned a few things, like there was some outages, Wi-Fi and stuff, but generally was everybody happy with the process?
Not the opposition to Bukele, obviously. The electoral candidate actually is set years in advance. Like, for example, for the next legislative and presidential election, we already know when that's going to be and when candidates are supposed to register, et cetera, et cetera. And so when we think about that, it's been sort of like on the go for a long time. Like candidates had to be registered by last October. And so if you don't know that's all that's happening, it seems like it happened rather quick. But to me, it's taken a long, long time because I've been sort of monitoring all that. But that was one of the criticisms by a lot of these international observers, is that it took too long, right? So what happens is, like, similar to what happens here in Canada, the scrutineers count the votes. Every party has a scrutineer or an observer, as well as the official elections body has an observer and basically a supervisor that signs all the declarations and the acts, they call them, right? And that happened relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. Is where the irregularities came is that inputting that manual process into the database, that's where the database was offline or wasn't accepting the entries. And so, but all that doesn't really matter because the manual acts were signed, there were witnesses, there were notaries present, everybody agreed, observers looked at them, and then all the manual stuff was available, right? Mm-hmm. So it took about a week and a half for the results to be official, but it was known that evening that what was happening, that they were that Bukele was the overwhelming winner. Mm-hmm. That New Ideas was going to be having an absolute majority.
It was just a matter of how much they're going to, how big the majority would be.
Basically. And the more that they went through a manual process of counting one by one in front of like everybody, and the more they counted in front of everybody, it was funny because like the more scrutiny came, like that was had in the whole process, the more like seats the opposition to Bukele lost, and they're like, oh, there's got to be something wrong. And it was just comical. And I sort of muse that, like, and this is true kind of for a lot of things, it's like when you don't like the results of something, you often blame the process, right?
Yes.
But seldom do people, in whatever it is, but in this case, the election, have like a kind of like a self-critical moment where they look at what they've done and say, you know, in their case, well, have we offered any alternatives, any viable alternatives that people can get inspired by, that people can stand behind, that we can actually, that we have a plan that we can concretely deliver? And the answer was no. Like their whole, like, you know, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to like park my biases and look at everything objectively and look at, you know, some of them didn't even have platforms. And so I just thought, well, you have to offer something to the population that they're inspired by. And they didn't offer anything that they were inspired by. In fact, most of them were saying, well, you know, all those things that worked in terms of cleaning up the crime, we're going to stop them because we're putting like innocent people in jail. the reality is that, like, you know, it's not a widely held view that that's what's happened. And in fact, there's interviews in local television of mothers of prisoners who say, I love my son. He is my son, but damn it, he belongs in jail. Don't let that guy out.
Yeah.
You know, cause yeah, he was terrorizing the neighborhood and, you know, I live in peace now, you know? And so that was really common. And, there's people that, and everybody had been affected by crime, myself included, you know? So I think that when these alternative or so-called alternatives to Bukele, you know, proposed different policies that sounded like they were going to ease up on security, it just pushed them further away. And so I think that, what's really happened here is that people want to continue, and like they've doubled down on the continuation of where Bukele is taking the country.
In terms of international criticism, I'm going to use that term. I know the BBC, there was a reporter that was talking to President Bukele, and he was asking him about this very topic, about the fact that they are jailing potentially innocent people. And he had a very good reply to this journalist. And he was saying, well, police in our country, the same as it is your country back in the UK, they're not perfect. They are going to jail people. Sometimes they'll make mistakes and they'll jail people that are innocent. That's why the court system exists, is to prove who is innocent and who is guilty. And he did a masterful job of proving that this criticism, yes, there may be some merit to it, but the reality is police, you know, they're based on the information that's given to them and they're going to act upon it. They're human beings. They don't have all the information. Even sometimes courts too will make decisions that are not, they could be, you know, bad decisions in the end, not truthful, but hopefully they fix everything. That's just the reality of it. So I just want to say, Bukele, he's been able to parry a lot of these criticisms, even internationally. And it was good to see him to take that BBC reporter to task. I'm not sure if you saw that.
I did. The simplicity of how he's able to disarm these erroneous arguments or rhetorical questions, because they're not questions at all, it's just amazing. Like, all I can think of is like a jiu-jitsu master just like doing, like, you know, somebody's coming in with all these like fancy moves and just immobilizing them with a couple of like holds and then tapping out, right? Because it's like he makes his questions or arguments look ridiculous just by the sheer examples and the simplicity of how he conveys and communicates. He's an excellent communicator, right?
Yes, he is.
And I think that he's quite talented. And I think this is why people fear him too, like him using those talents in a way that would harm. But I think, you know what? It's not just BBC reporters. Many Bitcoiners who first may have been like really enthusiastic about what was happening are now like hating on El Salvador for some reason. And it's like, okay, like, that's fine. But, you know, like at the same time, it's like, what's to fear about El Salvador? It's just this dinky little country who nobody even heard of up until this thing happened. And like, just let them do whatever and see what happens in 10 years. And if, you know, if you still don't like it, that's it. You don't, that's the thing, is you don't have to buy El Salvador.
Yeah,
leave it.
Look, there isn't, from my vantage point, there doesn't seem to be rampant human rights abuses going on over there, at least to me. You know, maybe one person or a few people who got are jailed, they may claim that, but the reality is the crime situation, the security has improved tremendously in the past few years. And I guess a lot of it has to do with Bukele's policies that he's put in place. So the people that have criticism, the Bitcoiners too, I wonder how much skin they have in the game. You and your family, they come from there. So, and you still have family there. You travel there periodically. So you have a much stronger connection to El Salvador than, yeah, I would say 99.9% of the people out there that are critical or even supportive of it. They may be supportive, but really the reality is they don't have a clue what's going on in comparison to somebody like you. So that's the one thing I'll take away from this. When you speak about what's going on there, I'm taking that almost as gospel, because let's be honest, I have no other connection to that. Actually, I got a few other connections,
yeah,
but really I take your information much more at face value. Sorry, much more as per gospel as per somebody else. I'll take it at face value. That's just, you know, randomly criticism about El Salvador. So I essentially say screw it. For those people, I would just say, you know, try not to let them get to you. You know,
I try to be balanced about it, right? Because, like, you know, and acknowledge that there is some potential, you know, problems, you know. And the one thing that I keep hearing from a lot of Bitcoiners who are often viewed or fancy themselves as, you know, libertarians, and I often question if they even know what that means, you know, because often they don't even know what classical liberalism is, or they don't know who John Locke is, or, you know, or Adam Smith, you know, the fathers of classical liberalism, right? But and they often throw quotes without really understanding the context. And one of the ones that they throw around is a Benjamin Franklin one. And can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's something along the lines that, you know, those who give up their liberty to obtain a little security deserve neither liberty nor security, right? And yep, Benjamin Franklin said that. But let's maybe explore in the context of why Benjamin Franklin would say that. And that was at a time when him and the 13 colonies were still negotiating some sort of independence from the crown, right? And so then, you know, the crown really didn't want to relinquish power. And they were sort of saying, look, you know, if you want to go at it alone, you know, you're going to, what are you going to do when your belligerent force, when belligerent people try to take over and overthrow, you know, your governments and your, and, you know, don't you want the British army there? And the reality is that for Benjamin Franklin, that was the context. It wasn't the context that it was that El Salvador faces. And from Franklin's perspective, I would argue, no, that you don't want to give up any of your freedom and your liberty, because, you know, they had food security, they had infrastructure, they had governance, they had an army, they had armament, they had all of the basic elements of a nation state, and they had absolutely no need for a colonizing power to look after them. So it's just ridiculous to even use that quote in the context of El Salvador, right? But, you know, it's a very click and baity kind of quote, and everybody gets excited, and it's like, yeah, Salvadorans are stupid. They don't know what they're doing. Yeah. So, but anyway.
Well, you mentioned also people are hoping that there'll be an improvement on the economy, especially after this election. It's one of the key points that Bukele and team are going to have to work on. Now, I'm looking at El Salvador. It's a very relatively small country, and I would imagine their economy internally can only be pushed so far. They're going to have to rely on a lot of external factors, namely their neighbors, Guatemala, Honduras, and so forth, and even further, Mexico and the United States. The United States, that's the currency which they use. So as the U.S. dollar goes, I would imagine as goes the El Salvador economy as well. So I'm just asking a long-winded question is, how impactful can they do domestically to improve their economy? Or are they like really, really reliant on external forces to help them move forward? Or do they have an opportunity to improve things internally to really improve their economy?
Okay. So It's difficult because El Salvador is in a rebuilding phase. It's one of the most densely populated countries in Central America. When we look at GDP alone, you know, it's got one of the lowest GDPs in Central America. Of course, it's the smallest country, and but it has many, many good things going for it.
Growth rate is high for GDP. I'm looking right now, 10% annual rate in 2021. I'm not sure anything since then. So that at least is very positive.
Right. I mean, a lot of people sort of argue it as kind of like the bounce back from COVID as well. But, you know, we can split hairs over that. I think that the reality is that El Salvador's a heavily mountainous. A lot of people don't think that because they only view the beach, the coastline, but it's heavily mounted, like a mountain range. Not a lot of prairies or plateaus for food cultivation, which is a huge problem for El Salvador because it does not have the ability to feed its own population. It imports most of its vegetables from Guatemala. It imports most of its beef. When people enjoy nice Salvadorian grass-fed beef, is actually Nicaraguan grass-fed beef. So it has to import a lot. It has to import its, actually it exported its energy this year, but it often imports its energy. It imports a lot of LNG. It imports many, many things. It's a net importer. It's not an exporter. And that's why it heavily relies on remittances. So El Salvador needs to change that. And, you know, what I understand is that the current Salvadoran government has taken the Singapore model as the one that it wants to follow. Singapore is a small, well, it's basically a city state. It can't produce much. So what is it going to compete on? Well, it's going to compete on its services. In Singapore specifically, it's financial services. And you look at the transformation of Singapore over the, you know, five decades, it's been formidable, right? And so that's what it wants to do. But, you know, how can we compete on traditional financial services when everything really is run out of Wall Street or, you know, probably Panama, right? So then this is where Bitcoin becomes important. It wants to be the financial center of the future based on Bitcoin. And it wants to really focus on IT and attracting IT companies. It's passed laws so that IT companies who set up shop in El Salvador are favorably taxed or not, or have a grace period in terms of taxes, right? It's built in a lot of incentives for a service-based, tech-based economy to set up shop in El Salvador. But, you know, Bukele knew that it couldn't really do, even if it did all of that and there was no security, there was really no point in doing it. That's why, you know, they addressed the security issue first. And now that that's in place, they're developing a lot of these things. And it's the same thing with the tourism, you know, like tourism. Sometimes one of the things that I hear is like, El Salvador is great, but the hotels suck. That's true because, you know, like we just don't have the infrastructure. Actually, a lot of people like that is the charm of being unspoiled yet, you know, and not having these like very Americanized, very sort of like sanitized kind of areas that, you know, don't look any different from any other American resort, right? So there's still a bit of that charm left, but it, all that is going to modernize. It's going to probably look more like what people are used to over the next 2-3 years. People have a small window to enjoy El Salvador as is, unspoiled.
So enjoy it while it's here. It may disappear and it may become more Americanized, which
loses charm. As it tries to seek more tourists, right? So
you mentioned something. You were comparing this whole process maybe to similar to how Singapore has it. Now, Singapore, they are very strict in their laws in terms of what you're able to import and do over in Singapore. So in terms of that, I can see there's some similarities, you know, the way things are getting more strict in terms of the security in El Salvador and trying to rein in all the security problems they had. Similarly, Singapore, they have very little crime because they have a diligent and militant force out there just to, you know, but
do you remember when there was a Canadian that like spat out gum and then he got like caned?
It was an American. So
Michael, an American? Yeah.
Michael something. It was under the Clinton administration. Yeah. And they were talking to the people in El Salvador to try to eliminate that, the caning. I think they managed to reduce the caning. I don't know what the number was supposed to be, but they reduced it. But still, it was
painful. I think he got it, though. Like they're like, yeah, okay, we'll do one less.
Yeah, it was double digit numbers from what I understand. But yeah, I think he did some graffiti in a car or something. Something really bad.
Yeah. I mean, just, I didn't know. I was.
Yeah, this was the mid-90s. So that was, you know, that's Singapore. Actually, I have other stories. I could talk about it because I have a now since the deceased friend who lived there, and he would tell me stories about how it was in Singapore, but I don't want to make this a Singapore discussion. But one thing they do have over there is mandatory military service. Does that also apply to El Salvador? Do Do you have to do military?
No, it's voluntary. It's voluntary military service. And in fact, it's a career for people. You know, there's different streams that people could go into. Like, they can go into policing. They can go into the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, it's a career now, whereas before it really wasn't. So.
No, that's cool. I know, like, other countries too. I know Italy has the mandatory service and whatever. I'm not going to go too much into that.
No, I don't think that is in the cards. I think that we still have a lot of open wounds from the Civil War, and where they would forcibly recruit people, and it never. Like that, I don't think they want to go there.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. Now, in terms of Bukele running again, is there any opportunity for him to run again, or is this his last opportunity? Or I don't know. I'm curious, like, are the laws restrictive? Are they going to change? I want to hear your thoughts about this.
As they stand right now, he cannot. In fact, the Supreme Court and the ruling that opened the door for him to run for a second term was quite prescriptive in saying that he cannot run for a third time.
So this is it
unless they change the constitution.
And I'm not gonna hold my breath about that one. Yeah, you know,
I think it's gonna happen.
Very good. Okay, I didn't want to go there. You know, if things are going really well and people are supportive of his policies, why wouldn't they be supportive of that type of temporary change to give an opportunity to run again or even in perpetuity? I don't know.
Because every Latin American country is exactly the same, and it's never worked in any other Latin American country. So why would it work in El Salvador?
Well, maybe, maybe not.
Right? I don't know. That's what I keep hearing. It's like, you guys, you're all just different kinds of Mexicans, and it's never worked for you.
Okay. Anyways, Bitcoin mining over there. You were talking about electricity, and you were saying that for the first time you were starting to export electricity, but still you guys are, or when I say you guys, El Salvador is an importer of electricity, right? Is that so? In terms of Bitcoin mining, that's probably still not going to be in the cards because it takes an extraordinary amount of energy to do it. And if you are importing energy, it doesn't make any sense to do Bitcoin mining. But I know that they were going to do that geothermal thing where they're going to use the geothermal energy from the volcanoes to try to use that for Bitcoin mining. But what's the status of this? I haven't heard much about their Bitcoin mining operation.
So a new hydroelectric plant actually came online about just earlier this year, and it's I don't know how many megawatts it's producing, but it's quite a bit, and that actually allowed there was a schedule raise in electricity in the electricity bill, and that plant coming online actually allowed the raise not to go up. In fact, people got a rebate or a bit of a discount because of that. And that allows that excess capacity to be exported to Honduras, Nicaragua, and Guatemala when needed. So from my understanding, any excess capacity can be easily diverted to things like Bitcoin mining. I know that in Berlin right now, they have some Bitcoin mining that is happening, and if you remember last week, actually almost 2 weeks ago, Bukele announced that there was the transfer of all the Bitcoin. Well, not all, but a large chunk. And I quote Bukele in his tweet, of their Bitcoin reserves into cold storage. And it was a lot more than the claimed DCA that they were doing. And in earlier tweets, he had said that That is actually because of mining capacity, as well as their passport programs and government services. So there's so they have been mining, and they have been obtaining Bitcoin from mining, and so they actually had almost double of what was estimated that they would have, probably a little bit more than double of what they estimated, and they're still DCAing
one per day, right?
Yeah. The Bitcoin wallet is actually public and people can see it. There's a lot of shit coins going in there too. A lot of ordinals, 546 Satoshis transactions. Lots of dust going in there.
Oh man.
BRC20s.
What are your thoughts of this whole new initiative for them to, as they claim, transfer a big chunk of their Bitcoin to a wallet? They say this is a physical wallet within their national territory. So to me, that seems like a good thing because it is one extra layer of preventing them from getting rugged. Yeah. Is, you know, leaving it into somebody else to deal with it. You never know what's going to happen, because they made some enemies along the way here too, right? So what are your thoughts on them now, you know, keeping this domestic and in their national territory?
Yeah, I would say that over the last 8 months, the relationship between El Salvador and the United States has been a lot more reconciliatory. They have good relations with China and they have good relations with Russia. So I would say that right now their foreign relations is actually at an all-time high, and considering everybody, you know, and not being subjugated at the same time, to our knowledge, I think that everybody is somewhat subjugated, including Canada. So I think that I think, and I wrote a little article on that. I think that it was a wise move, from what I know. And if somebody is able to prove me wrong, I will happily correct my articles and my statements. The custodian was BitGo, which is an American-based company. And so once they transferred it, my understanding is that, if BitGo was the custodian, then those funds would be transferred over to the cold storage wallet that is presumably in El Salvador.
That's amazing now that they have total control over it. Hopefully that they're using some sort of multi-sig and passphrase or something just to provide extra layers of security in terms of just one person getting access to that wallet and taking it all, because that's it's a large sum of funds that, like you said, it was much larger than what we were anticipating, and it was all partially due to mining and the passport, the residency services that they're offering up for Bitcoin investment in El Salvador.
The nature of that address and my understanding of how that's composed, it seems to be a multi-sig wallet. But I think that there are some very practical reasons why El Salvador and any other nation state that's collecting Bitcoin it's probably not going to be completely transparent. I think that it's probably wise to keep like an element of opacity around how their entire thing is constructed, right?
Yeah, I think they'll be able to instill confidence that they'll mm-hmm. Look, they're the first nation.
Yeah,
and right now the only nation that has Bitcoin as a currency.
Digital Fort Knox.
Fort Knox is a funny one. Do they actually have the gold is the question. I'd love to know if they actually.
I don't know when the last time it was audited, but if you go to the address right now, you can see how many Bitcoin El Salvador has.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at least how many they have.
So I'm going to field a question from the audience here. Now, Ballsy Golf is asking, which country is most likely to follow El Salvador's lead and adopt Bitcoin? Maybe just throwing this out there, if you have any idea who you think is next to do what El Salvador's doing.
As it is, I don't think people are going to follow the Salvadoran recipe, but I think the way that Argentina is going about it is okay, because they're basically saying you can transact in any currency and they don't have to actually make it legal tender. One of the things about making legal tender in El Salvador that benefits Guatemala in particular is that they have a law that, you know, people in Guatemala can transact in any legal tender currency as long as the accepting party is open to accepting that legal currency.
And they would be, because if they're accepting it, that's...
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say that as a template, I'm not sure anybody is going to follow it, because just like Bitcoin had success because it was off the radar of anybody, and it got to a point where they couldn't stop it, I think that if the next country was to sort of follow the same footsteps as El Salvador, it would be like sidelined right away. I mean, like, I think Honduras even mused with the idea, and then I think they got taken to the side and they were promptly scolded. At least that's the vibe that I get from what happened. So I think people have to like be creative about, you know, how they're going to do it. And I think Argentina has a pretty good recipe. And I think Francis Puglio actually said just remove capital controls around Bitcoin. And I think that kind of gets you most of the way there.
Yeah, agreed.
It gets you there.
That's all we want, is the ability to transact with it without dealing with the headaches of dealing with our tax people here, CRA, and other places, IRS or whatever. Jaime, do you have some time for a few more questions, or are you
sure, up
against the clock?
No.
I guess number one is, recently we had an announcement from El Salvador that they have eliminated income tax. 30% taxes were on investment for overseas and also for remittances. So I didn't know remittances were imposed a 30% tax, and that's now gone?
So it's just a transfer of money over certain amounts. Just like it's kind of like when you go to the States and you have to declare, like, you know, oh, I'm coming here and I swear I don't have more than $10,000 on me, right? And if you say that you have more than $10,000 on you, then you got to pay taxes on that,
yeah,
right? So now that's gone. Now you can go to the country and you don't have to pay taxes on if you're bringing more than that amount or any, yeah. Well, it's completely gone. You can bring as much money to the country. And I never really understood that, because if you're bringing money to the country, you're probably going to spend it there. So it's probably going to stay there. So why would you want to like tax it? You know, because they're going to spend it and people are going to like get like the benefit of that, right? So then you just create you're creating a disincentive or like of not bringing money into your country, because you know you're going to take 30% of people's money anyway, right? So I think it's a good move. And sorry, my dog's crazy.
It's okay. I didn't realize you had a dog. It's the first time I heard it bark. So in terms of then removing the taxes on investment from overseas investors, do you think this is going to have a huge influx of tech companies to try to set up shop within?
That's the idea, as far as I can tell, right? So that I think that's the play. I think the play is for not just tech companies, but, you know, possibly what the Cayman and, you know, some of these Caribbean and even Panama, like, you know, to set up your holdings companies there, right? I'm kind of like not super excited about what kind of, you know, unintended consequences that might bring too, because sometimes, you know, when you look at things like the Panama Papers and, you know, shady things that happens around like finances like that. I don't want El Salvador to become that, but I think that it is certainly trying to attract foreign direct investment, FDIs, right?
Yeah.
Some capital into the country, right?
Now, the last thing I want to touch on, and I think this might go a few minutes longer than I think, so that's why I think we're going to go past an hour. My first Bitcoin.
Yes.
You're involved with that.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about that more than anything else, but that's
Let's do it. We'll talk for the next couple hours. But I want to dive into this, because this is something that's really good. It's open source. And I'm giving the air quotes on this because it's available on, there's a GitHub. You could go to there get access to all the curriculum information. Yeah. This is a course that was initially being offered in El Salvador for individuals to learn more about Bitcoin. And the curriculum was, I think some of the things were creating a wallet, deleting the keys and restoring it somewhere else. Yes. So that's one of the things. How many people out there that own Bitcoin right now have done that?
No,
like how many people have, because that's one of the things
lots of people would fail. Lots
but yeah, go ahead. Let's talk about my first Bitcoin. I want to talk a little bit more. So the floor is yours, buddy. Go ahead.
No, for sure. And I'll openly admit that, like, I think some days I'm way over my head with this, right? Because it's such a popular program, and here's me LARPing my way through it. I'm at the point where in what you said at the beginning, it's open source, which means that people don't need my permission to use it. Go to the GitHub. And what's cool about the GitHub is that the new curriculum in English and in Spanish has been updated. So fresh, brand new translations, things are simplified, graphics are better. The writing is a lot better. Everything's so much better. So like, you know, this version's even better. And it's so easy. Like if people just want to like learn about Bitcoin and go through that document, it's so complete. It's so good. And for me, it's like what I get excited about is that like there's an essential piece about understanding money in very simplified terms. It's aimed at youth. But I feel like it is also because so many of us older folks don't understand money, because it's aimed at youth and using simplified examples and language, that it actually really makes it easy for all of us to learn. And I think in order to understand Bitcoin, you really need to understand money. And that's kind of where I feel like one of the most essential pieces and one of the most valuable things about the program lies in taking you through that journey, right? And so I have been able to, in my city, graduate a number of students who have been like, just amazed at like how much they did not know about our current financial system. And like and some of them shitcoiners who are like, oh yeah, I'm going to dump everything and just go all in on Bitcoin. And so but I'm wanting to spread this through Canada. And I think that there's the perception that like I need to do it. And there isn't. You don't need my permission. You just got to go to the GitHub, educate your family and friends first, and then start out in the community. And then just let me know how many people you graduated, how many people can restore their keys and make a functional wallet and transact. And I actually have been teaching this through high fees, by the way. So I'm also including another layer of testnet there because I want people to have the full Bitcoin experience. And so Lightning's not a problem, but when we do transactions, we use testnet so that people get full experience without, you know, paying an arm and a leg for their transactions, right? The other thing that I do teach is like the context under which we have to do this in Canada and in other, you know, more structured countries around taxes and finances is very different than in El Salvador, where it's actually money they can transact. So one of the things that I like stress early on to everybody is that we're going to do this in concept at first, and then when it's applied and we're using real Bitcoin, you are responsible for all of this, and you have to know where all of your Bitcoin goes. And so that's why we're going to do testnet. So all of the stuff on chain that we do, you don't have to think about the taxes or anything, but everything that you do after that on your own, you have to, because like, you know, like I'm not a financial advisor. I'm just teaching the technical piece, but you still should know that you're responsible for your Bitcoin, where it goes, and you should keep good good records of that, right? And even we do a little piece with Lightning, and I always say keep good records where you got it, where it went, because they may be just 10 satoshis right now. Who knows what that's going to be worth someday? And if the government needs to know, or what, you know, they whatever, then you at least have that record, right? Especially for a class. I mean, like, you know, we talk about good privacy hygiene as well, and as part of the course. And so then, you know, people can take that what they will and do best practices for themselves, right? But, you know, as far as me as an instructor, I'm concerned. I'm just giving people the tools so that they can make the best decisions for themselves. But, you know, as far as I go, I just make sure that everybody is well aware of their responsibility when it comes to taxes. So that's the main difference between teaching the course here in Canada versus in El Salvador and other places where you don't have to worry about capital gains and all that jazz.
Look how lucky they are that they don't lead the horse to water in terms of providing them the information. Yeah. It's up to them to drink and make sure that they process it correctly. In terms of the course, how often do you personally give that course? How often are you administering it?
So I've given one right now, and this year, last year I gave two, and we got another cohort that's probably over the summer, and it's a 10-week course, and so it's awesome. It's I got little props for it. I got like Monopoly money. I got even cacao beans, because we use that as commodity money, and it's real cacao. And so the Aztecs and the Mayans used to use cacao as a form of currency. And so I've kind of become like a bit of well, not an expert, like in terms of archaeological or anthropological, but at least in terms of Bitcoin, because I dove the cacao rabbit hole. And cacao, by the way, it's really expensive right now. It just like shot up.
Because of you.
Yeah, clearly. I bought a bag. So yeah, but it's really fun. And we actually have a teacher here that has been approved to teach it in the school system in their financial literacy class. And I think it's a first in Canada. So we're super excited about that. We also had like, it's, you know, we have it in consideration for a college program here in Canada, but I'm not sure how successful that'll be, but there's interest in it. So we'll see. And right now where I'm at with this is I need help. If you don't have to be an expert, you just have to have the will. And I'm compiling a Telegram group, and in the next week or so, I'm going to be texting everybody in that Telegram group about, you know, how to teach, give them the resources, and maybe do a bit of a Zoom or a Google Meet so that that we get going. Like I said, people don't need my permission, but I still like to know how many people you've taught and graduated, because my goal, at least for the year, is to graduate as many people as we can. Not sure if how achievable is, but other than El Salvador, the next biggest country of graduating people from this program. And so, you know, and you don't have to charge anything. It's free of charge. Like I saw on Twitter that, like, I don't know if this was serious or not, but this, like, one of these finance bro telling all these like dudes, it's like, you gotta buy like Bitcoin right now. You didn't pay just 5 grand for like this course, you know, just to blah blah blah, you gotta buy Bitcoin. And I'm like, what? People paid 5 grand for a guy to yell at you to buy Bitcoin? Come on, man. Like, just download it from Mi Primer Bitcoin for free.
I think, but I saw that video, by the way, that you're talking about. Yeah,
I guess some people need to be yelled at, I guess. I don't know.
So we have in the chat, Boomdust is saying, I want in on a Telegram group. Yeah. One of the guys at the Ottawa meetup is a high school teacher, and he wants to start a Bitcoin club at his school. So yeah, you guys get in touch.
Okay, so DM me like at Jamie or Jaimie W. Garcia. That's my Twitter or X handle. Just DM me. My DMs are open. Send me your Telegram handle, and then I'll add you to that. And I'll send some information in about a week's time.
In terms of the age of people, you were saying that generally for younger people, what would you say would be the youngest one should consider getting into this? And I guess as an upper age, it could be, you know, until your death, right? So the people, adults could be even attending this, I'm assuming, right?
I would say like my daughter's in grade 8. She would be like the prime candidate, I would say, to start to talk about this. And the course would address a lot of it. The course itself is aimed for high schoolers. So like maybe grade 10 to 12, right? But I've had people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and beyond taking the course. So,
and here we have somebody else in the chat saying, Saxtron 3000, 100% reaching out to hear Jaime. Thanks for launching in Canada. So it looks like you're going to get a second person from the chat that's going to be reaching out to you, just giving you a heads up on that.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of people that are wanting to take the course that you offer, is it in person, virtual? And if it's in person, where geographically is it?
So I've been offering the course here in Saskatchewan, and it's been in person. And I preferred it that way because, I really want to meet the people. I think, and just wanted to make sure that I was doing my pedagogy correctly. And actually, my wife's a teacher by trade. She doesn't practice it, but she told me it's actually not pedagogy, but andragogy or something like that, because I'm teaching it to adults mostly. So, I don't know. I don't know what that word means. It just basically means like the art of teaching or the method by which you teach and people gain that knowledge, right? So then the point is that like I'm teaching it mostly to adults, and I want to make sure that the methods that I'm using are striking and they're learning, and so that's why I prefer to teach it in person. And the course itself, they really propose strongly that you do it in meat space, which is just a fancy word for in real life or in the world, right? Because then you can have more interactive stuff going on, but it has been taught online, and I will do an online course in the fall, winter as well. But when it comes to like, if you want to be prepared to teach, I'm happy to jump on a Google Meet or on a Zoom call. And one of the exciting things that we got going on this year is that we got a couple people from El Salvador coming to the Canadian Bitcoin Conference in Montreal, and I'm going to be there, and we're going to do a bit of a presentation. And actually Bull Bitcoin has reached out to me about maybe doing a bit of a workshop for educators and stuff like that. And we're also working with the Canadian Bitcoin Coalition about, you know, how we can work together in terms of our education efforts. And all in all, I'm like, this is the one thing that I feel most excited about, most bullish about. And I think it's good because, it all starts with education. And this is non-biased education. We're not shilling a product. We're not shilling an exchange. We're not shilling anything. Like, it's completely independent, unbiased. We're not even shilling El Salvador or nothing like that. Like, it came out of El Salvador, and it's for the world, and it's free. I have charged nominal for the cost of running, printing the book if people want it, but you don't have to. That's the beauty of it. If you want to charge zero, or you want to charge for the cost up, you know, you can as a teacher, just to recoup some, you know, the printing and some of the props that you buy that you're probably going to reuse, right? You can, but it's like it's zero, right? And what I've done with my students, I've actually printed out a sheet and say, yeah, I've charged you this much for all of this today, right? And I'm not making any money.
does cost you to print and even to rent the space too. I mean, the space isn't free. I'm assuming not.
So luckily, I've been the guys Quick Bit Boutique here in Regina have provided the space for us. So they've donated that, but yeah, like, you know, you have to think about those things, right? If somebody's able to donate their time and their space, then for sure, you know, you can pass, you know, that no cost to your students, right? But if not, then, you know, the reality too is that, like, things sometimes when they're for free, people don't value them, right? And it's important for people as part of the course to understand that there's always a cost and a trade-off, right? So it's like, oh, you guys don't want to be charged anything? There's no book. The book's going to be virtual. You can print it on your own, right? So
you're just providing information and education. And with that, hopefully they'll be able to parlay this into something bigger and better. How did you were able to get this shoehorned into the curriculum in the school system over there? Because you were mentioning that somebody over...
So Tyler, who's the teacher doing this, he has been a Bitcoiner for a little bit. And so, like, he's kind of where we're at, right? He was like, kids need to know this. And I think that his superintendent was super, like, open to this idea. And he's like,
wow,
yeah, this makes sense to me. Go for it. So,
wow. That's incredible, because generally, you know, it's so restrictive and it's rigid in its approach. To have somebody within the walled gardens that have an open mind, this is unheard of in a lot of cases.
Well, this I'm not good. Screwing it up for them now. there's no phone call from this conversation. But I mean, the thing is like, it's like, you know, like let's embrace this, especially as Canadians, right? Like, I mean... Look, I mean, I'm from El Salvador and the goal is to move back there someday. But, you know, the reason why people left El Salvador to Los Angeles and Texas and everywhere else in the US and Canada and Sweden and Australia is not because they wanted to leave their family behind, but because they needed to. There was war. There was a necessity to leave, right? Now, my roots are here. You know, my wife's Canadian. My daughters, they have their friends and family here. We can't all leave El Salvador. Some of us have to stay here. And although at some point I will go to El Salvador and stay there, you know, a lot of us can't for right now. And so we have to make it better here. And I think this is part of it. And so some of the best Bitcoiners around the world are Canadians. Mm-hmm. And so, rather than push this aside, we have to embrace it and say, like, look, you know, we can't be afraid of this. This is just the progression of the internet, you know? And we have some of the best minds in the world doing this that are from here. And so why not, you know, make it better, right? So,
you know, in terms of how it's being accepted in Canada, we, in terms of a nation, Canada's pushing or pulling our weight quite well in the Bitcoin world. We have a fair number of Bitcoiners, prominent Bitcoiners here in comparison to other nations, and we have relatively small population. And also on top of that, say what you want about the country itself, the economy may not be doing as well as the United States, but in terms of how the laws and regulations pertain to Bitcoin, they're quite favorable in comparison to other jurisdictions. Yes. Here, you could buy Bitcoin. The government's not going to give you any issue. You can even buy KYC and no problems there. In fact, you're using Canada Post in one regard to their Yobo Bitcoin shirt. So with respect to that, Canada is a great place to be a Bitcoiner. So I just wanted to just, you know, there may be a lot of people out there that are down on the country for this or that reason. But if you take a step back and look what's going on, as a Bitcoiner, it's not too bad. We could be in a lot worse places than in Canada. So embrace it and take advantage while you can. Now, in terms of anybody that wants to do what you're doing, but do it on a different part of the country, say in BC, or what's the best approach? What type of skill set do they need? What sort of material or what do they need in order to start this? And
So essentially, like, I think that there's a lot of capable people. I think you need to be confident. So you need to be confident in your skills. You're probably the Bitcoin guy for a lot of your friends and family. So if you're that type of person, and even if you're not, but you think you're close, you probably that person. And the way that I would say is, like, send me a DM, go to my first Bitcoin's GitHub, download the PDF of the newest edition of the course, take a look through it, and start by teaching your friends and family. Grab your mom, your dad, your sister, your brother, a couple buddies, and just have them go through the course. So that's in a judgment-free environment, and that's all really you'll need after that point. I think you're going to be, for if you're that person, you'll probably be in a position where you can do this for a lot of people. But I would like to know who you are, because you don't need my permission to do this. You can just go ahead and do it without even telling me. But I would like to know, how many people are you graduating in your neck of the woods? So that we keep good records of how the course is being used. And I would like to get this to a point where we reward educators across the country. We're not at that point yet, but we reward educators across the country and people who are graduating and creating a good community of graduates in your communities are rewarded for your efforts, right? So
yeah, and Canada is a multicultural country, and I'm looking at the GitHub right now. I see four different translations. There could be more out there. I could have sworn it was Italian, but I see the English, the Spanish, Korean, and German version. So if you wanted to offer any of those different languages, you can do so, even in Canada. I mean, we have a lot of Koreans here. We have a small amount of Germans and Spanish-speaking
people. There's a French version coming out right away, too. So for our, folks over in Quebec and other Francophone communities. Actually, there's a big Francophone and Métis and Mi'kmaq community here in Saskatchewan, Manitoba. So, and all the different languages. I think there's a Punjab coming. So for Vancouver and Toronto and stuff like that. So, and other communities where there's a large Indian diaspora. So, there's a lot of information or a lot of translations that not only are useful across the world, but in communities here within Canada.
Were you involved at all with the translation of Spanish to English?
No, I made a small little correction. That's about it.
Okay.
That was all done by Salvadorians and people on the ground, like John Dennehy and such.
Very cool. Now, I guess we're getting kind of long in this one. Is there anything else you want to talk about my first Bitcoin? Because I don't want to end this before we exhaust this topic and you make sure okay.
I get passionate about this one because I've had a lot of fun doing it. Probably too much time doing it. And that's why I need help, because I'm still raising my family and I got other obligations, and I want other people to carry the torch. This does not have to depend on me. This is open source, and I want other Canadians to sort of take the initiative and do this with me and help me out in their communities, right? Because the thing is that I can't be in Toronto and Vancouver or in Montreal, where our biggest centers are, where there's more people to impact. So that's, I need help in those communities as well. Just send me a DM. I'll get you in the Telegram group and I'll send you some info shortly.
If ever you are looking to have it broadcasted as well, let us know and reach out to Joey or I on Twitter and we'll help it. So yeah, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. Any last parting words that you want to impose on us before we go? Because floor is yours, especially if people want to reach out to you after hearing about this. I mean, where could people reach you? Anything you want to talk about, you know, last few minutes here is yours.
No, I mean, you know, just enjoy life. We tend to forget that there's, especially now where spring has sprung in a lot of parts of the country, you know, let's get off the internet. I've actually unplugged a little bit while I've been sick, and I feel like that's sometimes better for my emotional well-being, away from the from the Bitcoin chatter and gossip, and so just enjoy life, enjoy family, yeah, do your 100 push-ups a day. That's the other reason why I got sick. I wasn't doing my push-ups.
So yeah, I gotta take the first part of it to heart, because this is going to be for me the summer of Len. That's a reference to Seinfeld.
Awesome.
I'm going to be enjoying this summer as much as I can. The last few summers I've been very, very busy, but this one I'm going to start enjoying. This, you know, price will be high. It's going to be a good summer for me. But anyways, I mean, thanks for coming on. If anybody wants to reach him, in the notes below on the video and audio, it's his Twitter or /X. You can just reach out to him from there. And yeah, buddy, thanks for coming on. And until next time, we'll have you. Whenever you have anything else, let us know, Jaime. We'll bring you back on, buddy. So let us
thanks,
know.
Len. See ya. Thanks, love, buddy.
Don't forget, everybody, lots of other stuff on CBP Media Network, including Two Whites and a Blue, me, Joey, my brother-in-law, Mike, and our friend Will talk about all the problems millennials are having with finance, romance, and just getting by. If you'd like CBP, if you like the NHL 94 podcast, I guarantee you'll like that one. Search for it, Two Whites and a Blue, anywhere you get your podcasts. We look forward to seeing you.